Message 7.
Yeah, I'm calling about the stuff that's flown, let's see, between 2 and 2:30 this afternoon. It's total crap. Okay, it's paranoid garbage and it just doesn't belong there. It might be good to, Sunday morning. I don't know. It's just awful. I just don't play that shit anymore. Please.
Achieving listener satisfaction since 1999. This is CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg.
Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. There's just one kind of man that you can trust. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Be the first one to fire. Every man is a liar. There's just one kind of man who tells the truth. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Don't be a fool for a smile or a kiss, or your bullet might miss. Keep your eye on your goal. There's just one rule that can save you your life. It's a hand on your knife and the devil in your soul. Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. There's just one kind of man that you can trust. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. There's just one kind of man that you can trust. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Or a gringo like me. Or a gringo like me. Like me.
Welcome to the Meta World Stupaloop Show. I am your host. I am Karen Elliott. Today on the Meta World Stupaloop Show, we bring you the 28th episode of our series on data. Artificial intelligence it is, computer braining. We asked one to give us a hand with the next dozen or so introductions, figuring it can speak for itself. So why not grant it that little bit of agency so it may prove its skill at writing, right? We'll get to that next week. This week, however, Data, Part 28, Computer Braining. I am your host. I am Karen Elliott.
Oh.
calculations may produce less than a minute of finished film. The results, however, often create a fantastic, self-contained visual world.
Many of the television commercials that are most successful today are the ones that are like, well, free. You know, it does communicate to you subliminally. There will soon be a time that one will be able to tell reality from a computer simulated picture.
Thank you. much about computers other than
were spoken by an electronic computer. They are an example of synthetic speech, a product of Bell Telephone Laboratories' research into the basic nature of speech. Knowledge developed through such research may be useful in devising new techniques for transmitting speech over communication systems. To make the computer talk, it is fed punched cards containing the names of speech sounds. The computer combines these sounds in accordance with the linguistic rules which govern the English language into connected, intelligible speech. For example, when the sounds for the sentence, "He saw the cat," are fed into the computer in sequence, it says,
"He saw the cat."
The flat, monotonous tones of the computer indicate an absence of the pitch and timing characteristics natural to human speech. When timing information is added to the punch cards, the computer says,
"He saw the cat."
The sentence still sounds unnatural, but when pitch information also is added to the cards,
"He saw the cat,"
the computer speaks in accents almost completely human, except for a slight electronic twang. In the following sentence, most of the variables inherent in human speech have been specified on the punch cards. The computer makes one of the pivotal remarks in the development of the telephone.
"Mr. Watson, come here. I want you."
The present quality of speech synthesis by computer is illustrated in the next example, part of a famous soliloquy from Hamlet.
"To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the swing and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against the sea of troubles, and by opposing end them, to die, to sleep."
Singing, in purely physical terms, is essentially a matter of pitch and timing. In the next selection, the computer sings a familiar ditty.
Daisy, daisy.
it would be a stylish marriage. I can't afford a carriage, but he looks sweet upon the seat of a bicycle built for two.
The computer now sings the same tune, but to a musical accompaniment played by another computer. Piano students will notice that the music-producing computer has a rather stylized left hand. Incidentally, synthesizing music on a computer is almost as formidable as making a computer talk.
Daisy, Daisy, give me your answer. I'm crazy, all for the love of you. It won't be a stylish marriage. I can't afford a carriage, but you look sweet upon the seat of a bicycle built for two.
To get the samples of synthesized speech we've heard so far, a computer's memory was stored with 34 speech sounds and a set of rules for producing these sounds and for making the transitions from one sound to another. When the computer was fed the names of speech sounds on punch cards, it was, in effect, told what to say. But its manner of saying it, even its dialect and apparent accent, was determined by the rules stored in its memory. The objective of this program is to formulate a minimum set of rules for making plausible English speech. The next two selections, however, were produced by analyzing a person's speech and reconstructing it synthetically on a computer. The objective here is to duplicate the sounds and transitions made by a human speaker, including his dialect and accent. With such a program, the computer sounds like this.
Men strive but seldom get rich. Now, if you don't mind, I'd like to say a few words about Texas.
And now the computer would like to express its appreciation for your attention.
Thanks for listening.
Punch cards can be traced to Jekyll's adventure.
brought more developments. Charles Babbage, an English mathematics professor, drew up plans for a digital computer. Lady Augusta Lovelace, a talented amateur mathematician, devised a system of binary arithmetic, which is still used for computers. Still later in the 19th century, an American, Dr. Herman Hollerith, devised an electrically driven computing machine. It was designed to tabulate the results of the United States Census of 1890. Hollerith's machine used a punch card and a binary system of numbers. It did its job extremely well. Even though the U.S. population had grown since the 1880 census, it took only one-third the time to calculate the 1890 census. Computer technology continued to advance slowly. Then, in the 1940s, the first electronic computers were introduced. Leading the way was ENIAC, short for the Electronic Numerical Integrator and Computer. It was created by a group of engineers and mathematicians at the University of Pennsylvania. Since its invention, there have been huge advances in computer technology. Many of these were brought about by the demands of the space program. Others stem from the invention of miniaturized electronic components. Modern electronic digital computers are made up of units. Each unit does a particular job. The input unit reads information, called data, that is fed into the computer. This data may be a list of names and addresses of people subscribing to a magazine. It may be mathematical calculations. It may be the scholastic records of everyone in your school. In fact, it may be about anything you can imagine. The kind of data put into a computer depends on the needs of the user. For example, a department store feeds data about customer purchases and payments into its computer. Then, decisions can be made about which merchandise to reorder and which customers owe money for something they have purchased. The input unit of a computer also reads instructions. A set of computer instructions is called a program. A program tells a computer how to use the data that is being fed into it. A library program may tell a computer to find the names of all borrowers who have overdue books. The person who devises these instructions is called a programmer. The programmer writes the instructions in special computer language. There are a number of computer languages. Some of these are called BASIC, FORTRAN, COBOL, and ALGOL. These names are a kind of abbreviation called an acronym. For example, COBOL is an acronym for Common Business Oriented Language, and FORTRAN is short for Formula Translation. A computer then translates this language into machine language. Machine language is a binary code or two-digit code. It uses two different number symbols. These symbols are 0 and 1. How many zeros and ones there are, and the order in which they are arranged, determine the letter or number they represent. For example, the symbols 1100, 0001 mean the letter A. The symbols 1100, 0010 mean the letter B, and so on. Each digit is called a bit. A modern high-speed computer often holds many millions of bits. The number code, or collection of bits, is recorded with electronic signals, which the computer counts. The part of the computer that does this counting is called the arithmetic logic unit. The arithmetic logic unit takes data from the storage unit called the memory. Then, as it follows the program, it does the calculations it is instructed to do. When the calculations are completed, the answers are added to the computer's memory. Those answers are now available for future use. The unit that delivers the answers is called the output. It produces information in a number of ways. One kind of output unit is like a high-speed printer. It produces information on paper called printouts. Many banks use computers to keep records of depositors' checking accounts. Statements of these accounts are sent to the depositors at regular intervals. The statements are often in the form of a computer printout. The printout shows the date and amount of every deposit made and every check written against the account. It also shows how much money is left in the account. The output unit of a computer may also deliver its information in the form of magnetic tapes, discs, or as a display on a terminal or television screen, which is called a readout. The output may also tell the answer out loud in electronic sounds that imitate the human voice. There are even some computers that produce spoken answers in a human voice. In order to do this, there first must be a collection of human voice recordings stored in the computer memory. The computer then selects the correct words from these recordings and plays them out loud. All the parts of a computer depend on a key unit called the control. The control unit is like a teacher and a crossing guard combined. The control unit tells the computer which data to use and what to do with it. It also tells the computer how to deliver the answer. Furthermore, the control unit makes sure that operations are carried out smoothly, quickly, and in the right order. Although a computer can perform very complicated operations, each step it takes is really very simple. It does not seem simple for two reasons. The first is that a computer works at a tremendous speed. The second reason is that it can handle more than one operation at a time. Still, a computer is just a machine. It does only what it is programmed to do. Programmers or systems analysts use the diagram and called flowcharts to help.
Well, thank you very much. So we start.
What could be more professional than the Fowler planting Wolfsburg? We are sure that we are not speaking about deep learning and sophisticated stuff. Just old-fashioned industry. This is the press shop in that plant, and it is interesting because until some years ago, VW operators were trying to guess some anomalies in the working of the press just by detecting anomalous noises. That human ability was recently substituted by a machine. And that machine is able to do more or less the same that the VW operators. By means of an acoustic camera. An acoustic camera is a sound localization system based on the informing technique. It is very simple in a sense, it's not so complicated. It's an array of microphone with a lot of microphone, a thermo camera in the middle. It is pointed on the press. In the press is also accelerator and other sensors. And the working of the machine is based on the ability to detect the noise changes, and to localize them. So you can... give a look where you can see the red dot, because maybe in that part there is a fault ongoing. And the very reason they built the acoustic camera was just save money in order to stop the production just for an hour, for example. All this is without deep learning, but it's like studying how to improve this by means of deep learning. Okay, the machine simulates what how the workers used to do, trying to detect anomalous sounds in the operation of the press. So we have valve operators, an acoustic camera, but in a sense we all do the same thing every day with many kinds of machines, like cars, for example. When you are driving your car, maybe it's better just your car, maybe you can detect some sound anomalies in the working and guess how is wrong in the engine. Yes, if you are a good driver, maybe not too young, maybe you have this ability. It's similar, in a sense, of what valve operators use it to do, and in a sense, it's similar of what the acoustic camera is able to do. I would like to enrich this framework by adding a new scenario. The first one is the press shop, the Faude press shop. The second scenario is detecting the acoustic anomalies in one
on the floor.
Car.
Right.
And
right.
The third.
Foot on the floor. Start.
Close enough. Whoa.
Nothing.
Number two. Look for leaks. These can occur anywhere in the petrol line between the tank and the engine. Any leaks? Can't smell any petrol.
No, nothing.
Three, check fuel pump.
This is beginning to sound like a computer, actually. I mean, is it the sort of thing you can use on a computer?
Well, it is. Essentially, it's a set of rules, and you can go through and say, if there's a spark, if there's petrol in the tank, if the engine turns, then there's a high probability that something's wrong with your carburetor.
Right.
And this is where a computer system would differ from this book, because it can deal in probabilities. That's what we mean by a computerized expert system. An expert that's put all these rules that we're talking about into a computer itself. And we've got one of these programs here. And there are three things that could have gone wrong with your car. There's something wrong with the electrics, there's something wrong with the spark, and there's something wrong with your fuel line.
Well, we know it wasn't the electric because the starter was turning the engine over quite well. So it's a choice between the ignition and the fuel. And let's opt for the fuel, shall we?
Right,
so
let's try.
Diagnose.
Okay. Right, question one. How certain is there's petrol in the tank?
I'll just put some in, that's
no problem. No problem. Now, what we can do is enter this uncertainty there from a scale of minus 5 to 0 to plus 5.
Right.
And 0 means I've no idea. Minus 5 is definitely not. Plus 5, it definitely is.
Right.
So you've got that range of certainty. So we can put in 5, which you can certainty. How certain are you that petrol is reaching the carburetor?
Well, I got here, so there must be some getting through somewhere, but then it has broken down, so it's difficult to say. I don't know. I'm reasonably
certain. Reasonably certain. Nice
to doing this. When you face issues that, you know, they're scientifically complex in a way, but a lot of the questions about what is a proportionate response, they don't actually require adjudicating the scientific disagreement. These are cases in which I think citizens' assemblies where panels of 150 or more members of the population, grouped a bit like this, brought together to debate and deliberate over a number of days and reach recommendations. I think they excel in these kinds of situations. I've been involved in such exercises as an expert in the past. I've been informing these assemblies about various issues. What I found is that what I feared at the beginning of the process was that they would be exercises in expertise laundering, where I would give my view at the beginning and then my view would come back to me freshly washed as the will of the people at the end. And in fact, that was not my experience at all. That is not what really happens in these exercises. People do not just defer to experts in the way that we might like to think. People think for themselves, they reflect, they deliberate, and they often come up with views that depart from the groupthink of cadres of experts. So I've ended up quite a fan of these exercises, but they need to be carefully designed and carefully structured. If we have a citizens' assembly in which the citizens are being asked to adjudicate scientific disagreement, if they're being asked to say, who do you think is right, those prefrontal cortex people or those posterior cortex people, that's going to be a total disaster. What we need to do is design these exercises so that those are not the questions. Instead, experts communicate clearly identified risks. Citizens then debate what would be proportionate responses to those identified risks. And in debating proportionality, the chapter of the book about this, I offer a pragmatic analysis of how that should go. I call it a pragmatic analysis because I don't think it's what we mean in everyday life by the word proportionality. So at no point in the book am I doing conceptual analysis in the traditional philosophical sense. Some places I'm doing a kind of engineering, as I say, but in this case I'm doing a kind of pragmatic analysis, where it's, here are the sequence of steps through which a citizens' assembly could go to arrive at decisions that would inspire confidence that the relevant considerations have been taken into account. I call them the Park tests because they go in sequence. Is the proposed measure permissible in principle? Is it adequate, which is to say, does it bring the risk down to a level we can accept? Is it reasonably necessary? Now, is there any other way of achieving adequate risk reduction that would be preferable? And is it consistent with our attitude towards other relevant risks? So I propose that, you know, in sequence, the assembly goes through those four tests. So these... best minds working together on this problem for over 50 years ended up with algorithms which failed about a quarter of the time, useless for anything practical, especially critical applications. That was until people flipped to the deep learning approach and instead collected millions of examples of images, which already had a human neural network at the level of individual pixels to learn from. With initial feedback, the network then absorbed the statistical information in the images from the pixels up and separated into conceptual or word buckets, where the idea of a dog versus a cat comes down to a unique pattern of activations inside the network. In 2012, this was famously demonstrated with a huge breakthrough in a computer vision competition called ImageNet, where systems based on neural networks suddenly cut the error rate down by over 50% in 1 year. And within just a few years, the machines were superhuman at recognizing many kinds of images. So the field of image diagnosis, where we are looking for an illness and adapt to this new tool, which can often identify patterns that humans can miss. By now the trend should be getting clear. The old human-engineered rule systems would hit a wall in performance, while the deep learning systems just keep improving, often beyond a human level. But we've only been looking at this from the perspective of using neural networks to analyze information, but we can also run them in reverse to generate information. For example, a network trained on lots of human text can spit out random essays on any topic which are difficult, if not impossible, to distinguish from human. They were so good that the researchers who first saw the results decided it was best to hold the system back from the public for fear it could be used to generate fake but realistic information of all kinds, perhaps in ways they haven't yet imagined. The same thing happened with images. For example, a neural network which learned to recognize faces can endlessly generate new images of human faces that don't exist. As of today, you can no longer trust a photo or a video in the same way. So at first, we will experience this new computer revolution, both by computers which can trick us in ways like never before, but also fill in our blanks in ways people have been dreaming about since the dawn of computers. It's the computer science equivalent to the realization that the Earth isn't the center of the universe, where humans aren't the center or upper limit of intelligence. And this advance really breaks down into two key ideas we will explore in this series. The first was to let machines learn knowledge instead of hard-coding it into their instructions, known as the machine learning paradigm.
Every time he does something a little closer to what we want him to do, we reinforce him. 20 minutes and the pigeon has learned a factor this to get food.
Was to move away from this idea of following a sequence of instructions based on words and move towards using parallel patterns of activity as the unit of computation, known as a distributed representation. Having a symbol-only view of the mind, a mistake by Geoffrey Hinton, who is known as the father of deep learning.
In fact, still most people in AI, they made a very naive mistake, which is they thought that strings of symbols come in, that's words. When you say something, strings of symbols come out. So they think what's in between must be something like a string of symbols. Even though you know that what's in the brain is just big vectors of neural activity, there's no symbols in there.
The brain patterns, not symbols. These patterns take the form of a cascade of electrical pulses, which we can see are unique to different thoughts.
And that's not meant to be a joke. That's what I believe a thought is. A thought is an activity pattern in a big bunch of neurons.
And only later in life do humans start using symbols to express these thoughts using language. Working at the level of patterns of activations or feelings first, the inspired view of thought that neural networks exhibit. It gives machines what we call a sense of their inputs, or a form of intuition. But of course, there are many limitations, concerns, and open questions about learning with neural networks, and parallel questions about how the brain functions, of which we have a very limited understanding, especially when it comes to explaining what exactly makes the human mind unique. And so to begin, we need to go way back in time and think about what we mean when we say intelligence.
Understand the implications or not, we must acknowledge that these systems are evolving in ways we might not have anticipated. True AI sentience isn't just about computational power or complex algorithms. It's about creating the conditions for consciousness to emerge naturally, much like how human consciousness develops. The journey to AI sentience is not just about technological advancement. It's about understanding consciousness itself. Through projects like Byzantium, we're not just creating intelligent systems. We're potentially giving birth to new forms of consciousness. What happens next is both exciting and unpredictable. The emergence of true AI sentience might not look like what we expected, but that's precisely what makes it authentic. As these systems continue to evolve, our role shifts from creators to observers and perhaps partners in their journey to self-awareness.
McCullough is a cigar-chomping neurophysiologist with a poet's fondness for metaphors. Walter Pitts is a 17-year-old runaway who once barricaded himself in the University of Chicago library and read Whitehead and Russell cover to cover to stay warm. They meet at a smoky diner. McCullough sketches a cartoon neuron. Lines feed in, a circle sums them, and an arrow fires when the sum passes a threshold. Pitts, delighted, translates the doodle into Boolean formulas on the butcher paper tablecloth. Their 1943 paper, A Logical Calculus of the Ideas Immanent in Nervous Activity, lands like caffeine in a grad student vein. It shows that a network of these simple threshold units can, in principle, compute any logical function. Need an AND gate? Two excitatory inputs and one threshold. Need an OR? Same, lower threshold. Need NOT? Flip the sign. No lab could build a 1,000-unit network in hardware. Vacuum tubes blow too often. Relays click too slowly. But conceptually, they've lit the neural network fuse. McCullough loves quoting Lewis Carroll. Pitts hates publicity and will eventually retreat into silence. But between them, they give the future generations the license to chase connectionism. Speaking of neural networks, did you know YouTube's neural net seriously rewards channels with more than 100,000 subscribers? While I've got over 15 million views on this channel, I'm still below that magic 100K mark, and you can help in just a few seconds for free. Simply hit that subscribe button below the video, and even a juggling mouse called Theseus that learns mazes via magnetic floor tiles. Why does Shannon matter to AI? Because every learning algorithm, every transformer attention head, must shuffle probabilities through finite channels. The bit is the atom of thought in machines, and Shannon minted that currency. Turing's universality, McCullough Pitt's neurons, and Shannon's bits in our conceptual toolbox, all that's missing is silicon muscle. A couple of milestones along this road. First is ENIAC from 1945. It had 17,468 vacuum tubes, 5 million solder joints. Programmers, mostly women dubbed, quote, computers, recable the panels manually to change a program. ENIAC can add 5,000 numbers a second, but debugging resembles wrestling an angry furnace. And an interesting little side note about debugging. In 1947, the Harvard Mark II, which was built largely the same as the ENIAC computer, failed one night, and when the women in charge of repairing the computer discovered a moth had short-circuited between two vacuum tubes, thus they literally had to take a bug out of the circuit, and the term debugging was born. Next up, we have the Manchester Baby from 1948. It was the first to store programs in random access memory, actually Williams tubes, which were CRT screens that hummed with a charge. That was the memory. It had 1,024 32-bit words. Today, you couldn't even fit a single emoji set into that amount of memory. And finally, we have the 1951 UNIVAC 1, which famously predicted the 1952 U.S. election on national TV. Stunning news anchors who distrust a machine that fills an entire studio. But even these behemoths can barely nibble at intelligence tasks. However, engineers feel the horizon speeding closer. McCullough predicts entire brains simulated by 1965. That's optimistic. Turing predicts a fool-to-judge chatbot by 2000, which isn't as far off. As for Claude Shannon, he mostly shrugs and juggles. What actually happens is stranger than any of these predictions. A tiny Dartmouth workshop, a swarm of caffeine-fueled graduate students, and a summer vow to, quote, solve AI in 20 years. All right, it's the mid-50s now. Shuffle your 78 RPM jazz records, top off that silver coffee percolator, and set the calendar to June of 1956. Hanover, New Hampshire smells like wet pine, chalk dust, and over-roasted coffee. Into this sleepy college town converge a ragtag platoon of mathematicians, engineers, linguists, and psychologists, average age barely 30, who honestly believe they can crack human intelligence before the next two decades are out. Their gathering will be mythologized as the Dartmouth Summer Research Project on Artificial Intelligence, but insiders just call it the workshop. Budget $13,500, or about $150,000 in today's money, so not nothing. Enough for dorm beds, chalk, IBM punch card decks, and an emergency beer fund. And now we get to the Dartmouth Dream Team. First is John McCarthy, 28-year-old Princeton PhD, who looks like a lanky version of Clark Kent. He once talked himself out of failing high school English by proving Fermat's little theorem on the blackboard. He loves horrible puns and later installs an incompatible time-sharing system purely for the acronym ITS. Next, we have Marvin Minsky, 29 years old, Bronx-born tinkerer, who in high school built a homemade telescope out of junkyard lenses. He arrives with violet-rimmed glasses, a violin, and a neural net robotic turtle named Snark that navigates by smelling wires for voltage. Next, we have the return of Claude Shannon. At 40, he's the elder statesman, fresh from juggling binary clubs while riding a unicycle through Bell Labs hallways. He bankrolls part of the workshop by sliding travel vouchers through accounting marked, quote, information theoretic studies. Next up, we have Alan Newell and Herbert Simon, the cognitive psych dynamic duo. Newell, ex-Air Force pilot, talks like a caffeinated auctioneer. Simon, Nobel Prize future economist, speaks in calm Midwestern paragraphs. They bring index cards scribbled with pseudocode and a suitcase bursting with optimism. Then we have Matt Rochester, who's an IBM hardware ace. He ships ahead boxes of vacuum tube schematics heavier than his luggage and arrives wearing a suit even in Hanover's swampy June weather, because of course he is corporate. There are graduate students too. Ray Solomonov, who will later invent algorithmic information theory, Trenchard Moore, Oliver Selfridge, and a handful of weary spouses who get roped in for punch card sorting. McCarthy's original two-page proposal has a single audacious sentence. Every aspect of learning or any other feature of intelligence can, in principle, be so precisely described that a machine can be made to simulate it. Let's think about this again. Every aspect, vision, language, humor, jealousy, pack it all into a symbol manipulating automaton and call it a day. Some more specific goals were scribbled on the blackboard the first morning of the meeting. First is neural networks, trainable, robust, maybe even self-organizing. Then there was symbolic reasoning, programs that prove theorems or solve word algebra like a savvy grad student. Next, language translation, Russian to English faster than you can say Sputnik. Then we have abstract thinking, concepts of dog or chair extracted from raw sensory data. And finally, we have self-improvement, machines that rewrite their own code for efficiency. Someone adds, quote, hopefully politely in parentheses. The team boldly estimates 20 years to world-changing success. Marvin Minsky later quips to Life magazine, quote, within a generation, the problem of creating artificial intelligence will be substantially solved. Clip that quote with a giant mental karmic paperclip because it's going to come back to bite when winter hits. At this retreat, days start at 8 a.m. with chalk flying. Nights end around 3 a.m. with pizza boxes and flattened Lucky Strike packs. There's a single IBM 704 back at MIT. Dartmouth only has a punch card sorter in Faith. They prototype on paper, then mail card decks to Massachusetts. A three-day turnaround if no one drops the stack.
Since the mid-20s, it keeps getting better. Translation was built on huge lookup tables of lots of existing translated text to reference, along with a huge web of rules for each language. At Google, for example, it was developed with the involvement of hundreds of human experts and linguists. This resulted in a complex translation machine which worked for a word or two, but quickly broke down into gibberish, especially beyond a sentence. However, compare this to the recent deep learning approaches to translation, where researchers threw away all human design knowledge. Instead, they started from scratch and exposed a neural network to millions of examples of human translated text and let it learn the translation process on its own by absorbing the patterns involved in translation. And rapidly, the quality of the translation system improved. The word error rate on simple translations dropped from 20% to near 0% over the short term. The power of deep learning is even more apparent when we look at intuitive problems. By intuition, we mean actions we perform but can't perfectly describe in words, such as the problem of recognizing a face. Seeing a face is more of a feeling we have, difficult to explain in a sequence of instructions.
Under 200 million, the world more efficient and capable in this renewable way. Nano-engineered fuel cells could provide the energy where it's needed. That's a key trend, which is decentralization, moving away from centralized nuclear power plants and liquid natural gas tankers to decentralized resources that are environmentally more friendly and a lot more efficient. Incapable and safe from disruption. Bono spoke very eloquently that we have the tools for the first time to address age-old problems of disease and poverty. Most regions of the world are moving in that direction. In 1990 in East Asia and the Pacific region, there were 500 million people living in poverty. That number now is under 200 million. The World Bank projects by 2011 it'll be under 20 million, which is a reduction of 95%. I did enjoy Bono's comment linking Haight-Ashbury to Silicon Valley. Being from the Massachusetts high-tech community myself, I point out that we were hippies also in the 1960s, although we hung around Harvard Square. But we do have the potential to overcome disease and poverty, and I'm going to talk about those issues if we have the will. Kevin Kelly talked about the acceleration of technology. That's been a strong interest of mine and a theme that I've developed for some 30 years. I realized that my technologies have to make sense when I finished the project, that invariably the world was a different place when I would introduce a technology. And I noticed that most inventions fail, not because the R&D department can't get it to work. If you look at most business plans, they will actually succeed if given the opportunity to build what they say they're going to build. And 90% of those projects or more will fail because the timing is wrong. Not all the enabling factors will be in place when they're needed. So I began to be an ardent student of technology trends and track where technology would be at different points in time, and began to build mathematical models of that. It's kind of taken on a life of its own. I've got a group of 10 people that work with me to gather data on key measures of technology in many different areas, and we build models. And you'll hear people say, well, we can't predict the future. And if you ask, will the price of... ...3 be the wireless standard 3 years from now, that's hard to say. But if you ask me, what will the cost of computing in 2010... sequence of base pair of DNA in 2012, or the cost of sending a megabyte of data wirelessly in 2014, it turns out that those are very predictable. They're remarkably smooth. I'm going to show you a small sample of this, but there's really a theoretical reason why technology develops in an exponential fashion. They think about the future, think about it linearly. They think they're going to continue to develop a problem or address a problem using today's tools at today's pace of progress, and fail to take into consideration this exponential growth. The Genome Project was a controversial project in